guests I've had on Dan Really Likes Wine over the years, and there have been some fairly impressive ones. This week's guest on the podcast might have the single biggest seller we've ever encountered. And that's because he's got one of the biggest jobs in South African wine, as he should. He's one of the great South African sort of sommeliers. We've adopted him. More on that later. And he also introduces every single day, not hundreds, but thousands of bottles of wine to people across South Africa, because he is sommelier in chief and the man who runs the wine business at Southern Sun. He's also a Mauritian superstar who now calls South Africa home. Miguel Chan, welcome.
Thank you, Dan. Always a pleasure. And it's a privilege to be on your show.
Lovely to have you on as the curator custodian of so much wine. I was trying to work out, adding up all the Southern Sun hotels in my head, and then working out, well, they've each got a cellar and a wine list and according stock. How many bottles of wine, roughly, do you think you oversee?
Well, when I look, the bigger picture is just of a 40 wine list. So when you break it down according to the hotel category and the food that they serve and the wine selection, I never really work it out in terms of number of bottles that we have in total out of the 40 wine lists or so. But let's put it in context. The bigger wine list will carry anything up to 200 different SKUs or different wines. And you look at a post-stock level of 60 bottles per wine. You do the maths. It's quite a reasonable number. You multiply it by 40. You end up with quite a good number of bottles spread across
South
Africa.
That's nudging towards 500,000 bottles of wine.
It could be around that number. Yes.
That is a wonderful wine collection to be able to have, but also quite a daunting one to manage.
It is daunting because wine is complex in any measure. And the fun side of wine is obviously to share the bottle and open a glass with people that, you know.
Which we do regularly.
Exactly. But the reality is you have to understand the intricacy of the market. And that's where it's one has to be really shrewd in a way that how to actually put a selections together. It's not a Miguel Chan choice. It's not Miguel Chan taste. I tell you the truth. If I have to make a wine list to my taste, there will be two varieties. There will be Riesling as white, Pinot Noir as red. And take it or leave it.
And you will have nobody ordering wine.
And that's it. I'll be out of business. I'll be out of a job
immediately.
Overnight.
You're able to set aside your personal preference and know what people drink because you have been doing this for so long. But I'm fascinated as to how this might have started because I've spent a lot of time in Mauritius. I love Mauritius. But Mauritians generally are very badly behaved people. They never go to bed on time. They have these wonderful big feasts, Kari Rougais and Faratas, and these amazing, often Creole infused dishes, but they tend to wash it down with rum and with jungle juice and with cold Phoenix beers. And wine is certainly in my early days in Mauritius wasn't something I always saw unless I was at a top restaurant or at a top resort. So how does this young kid in Mauritius, who's probably running along the beach looking like a young Mauritian David Hasselhoff, find himself in the wine industry and discover that wine is actually something that might turn into a career?
Well, it all started when I was around 5 years old.
That's a good time to be starting wine.
You know, you have to start somewhere in life. And my grandma always loved her wine. And she loves playing loto. And every weekend at the home, she will have bottles of Châteauneuf du Pape or Beaujolais as red. And there will be rosé. In those days, there were the South African rosé in 2-liter glass bottle with a little handle next to it. I think it was Keller Prince, something along that name.
I remember the bottles.
And a green bottle. And these were the staple on the table every single weekend. And I would throw a tantrum as a kid. Why was the adult being given wine? I was given Coca-Cola. And one day she gave me a little bit of red wine diluted with water. That was one way to calm me down, and I felt being accepted amongst the adults. Little did I know that 15, 17 years later, I would enter wine. And it all started seriously when I was in hotel school. I was head of class, We were 22 in the class, and the first one exam I came last as the head of class with an amazing score of 4 out of 20. And the principal of the head of school made me stood in front of everyone as the head of class, why my result was so great. And it haunted me for the 3 years I was at the head of school. And I say, never again in my life I will be embarrassed in front of the class as a head of class, and I will do whatever I can. I will learn, I will burn the midnight oil, and I will cruise every single one exam since.
It reminds me of Artie Badenhorst famously getting 58 out of 100 from a wine judge, which was, I think, the worst score any winemaker has ever got for a wine ever, and it convinced him to make sure he never did that again. You had pretty much the same thing.
Exactly. Once you get bruised at that magnitude, trust me, it stays for life, and it's the motivation behind where I am today. And little by little, I realized that wine is fascinating in itself, because when I went to the hotel school, all I wanted to be was to specialize in food and beverage. And then I realized that everyone was following the same path. And back in the days, the year was 1996, we had the first French sommeliers working at one of the resorts in Mauritius, and it happened I was doing my practical training there. And the only way to get out of the food and beverage environment, although it is critical to be a good sommelier, is to understand F&B operation, is to actually understand what wine management, wine engineering, wine engineering is all about. And that was my first experience of working with a sommelier. And I said to myself, you know what, it's pretty cool. And I went deep into it. Majority of my friends at school, they're still in F&B operations or hotel general managers. I'm the only one that went the other route.
You're the success story, Miguel.
You know, it's been fun. It's been an incredible journey of the last 25 years. I've got to discover the world, see the great winemakers, see the great vineyards, and 22 years in South Africa. What was meant to be a 6-month job in Constantia Valley, opening a wine bar, never left. And today, here on your show.
The inversion of the usual story is one that appeals to me greatly. We normally see South Africans, they've watched too many episodes of Carte Blanche, right? We can't take it anymore, we're leaving. New Zealand's too far, Australia's full of Australians, Canada looks freezing, so we're moving to Mauritius, and off they go. And I think if you go to Black River, there's more Afrikaans spoken than there is English, French or Creole. But you came the other way around and you moved across to the Cape for those 6 months. What was the wine bar, and how long did it take for you to start think, hang on, maybe this will be more than 6 months?
Well, first thing first, the reasoning behind accepting first the job, the 6-month job in Constantia Valley, was South Africa is the closest vineyard to Mauritius. And it was only a 4-6 hour flight away. And secondly, the wine bar in question was at the famous Sellers Hoorn Hotel, Relais Chateau property by the late Lise Magra.
That's quite an attraction.
And yeah, so I remember I flew in for the weekend, had an interview with her, never heard anything for the first 6 months, and one morning got an email saying, hey, you got the job, but it's only for 6 months. I was like, all right. I was 20 years old, took the chance, and the rest, as we say, is his story. And after 6 months in Constantia, she approached me. She said, you're staying another year. We're extending your work permit. Got it renewed 3 times, and a good 6 years later in Constantia Valley.
And we haven't been able to get rid of you since.
Well, it's true. Every time I've asked myself the question, or I've been told the same, of how long I've probably overstayed here in South Africa. But the fun part is, back in the days, in the early 2003 to 2009, the South African industry was going through a transformation, a silent transformation which no one else was paying attention to. And I believe as a sommelier, it was the right time to be when the changes and the action was happening. As a sommelier, I could have gone to Europe and followed the classic way of working in a Michelin star restaurant or any fine dining outlet. You follow the protocol for the next 40 years of your life. You work with the great wines of France, Germany, Spain, Portugal, Italy, and you're stuck there. You don't grow any further than that. Being in South Africa, seeing the revolution, seeing how the Swartland came on board, seeing the refinement of the Stellenbosch Cabernet, seeing the resurgence of Chenin Blanc, and today we're producing if not the best Chenin Blanc in the world, in the diversity of style. I've seen the rise and rise of Cab Classic from a minute production to a monster where it is today, and the quality just get better and better every year, as well as the aspect of innovation, an industry which is super dynamic, resilient, an industry that gives so much, an industry that keeps on pushing the boundaries. So all these things contribute to makes life richer, and as a sum, it's gold. It's priceless to experience and to be part of all this development and to build a relationship with the stakeholders of an industry, including yourself. It's to actually, we all have a role to play as being a good ambassador, making people drink more wine and take the pretentiousness away.
Now, you could do this job up to a point quite easily, because where I could say to somebody, this wine is nice, and I go, well, that's pretty boring. You can say, well, this wine is nice in your beautiful Mauritian French accent. Here's this suave guy selling me wine. You could say anything, and it just sounds amazing. But backing up this cool French Mauritian image is the fact that you do actually know so much about wine. And although there is the French knowledge and understanding, you certainly have that, you have a depth of understanding of South African wine that I'm both very admiring of and deeply envious of, because I wish mine was remotely close. And that comes from not just, well, this is my job. This comes from an absolute passion for South African wine, but also for the people who make it.
Indeed. You know, Dan, it's passion is everything. And the key to keep the passion flowing is to continuously learn, taste, and be humble. Very important for some. We are not rock stars. We are the intermediary between the producer and the guests, and our role is to be a good ambassador and to maintain the humility and the humbleness that the profession carries, which is pretty or very much old school way of thinking. Things change, and it's a job that takes a lot of time, many years of studies. It took me a good 8 years into the profession to start feeling comfortable about it, to be able to talk about varieties, to be able to talk about regions, to have the confidence to sell great bottle of wine. It's not something that happened overnight. Even though we may spend hours in books tasting a lot of wines, it's not about pushing a wine down the throat of a customer. It's to understand the psychology of the buyer, understand he or she, what's the occasion, what is their budget. Selling the most expensive bottle of wine is one surefire way to kill the whole experience. Building the trust is the most important thing into the job itself. And that's how we slowly build a name for ourselves into the industry. And be honest. Have the integrity to be objective in our approach. To you as a producer, to the winery, to the winemaker, say it as it is. For a long time, when I was young, I was quite outspoken. I was kind of being labeled as the bread police, where everyone felt it is a swear word to talk about bread in a tasting room. But I was outspoken about it because an industry cannot survive on it. The French will call it terroir, but it's not terroir. It's a defect. And as long as we can constructively talk about defects into wine and improve, and not use any other excuses like terroir or any source of character into the glass, this is how we all grow together and make better and better wine.
If you're not sure about Brett, no, he's not a winemaker. Google Brett in wine and you'll get an understanding of exactly what Miguel is talking about. And you do talk with great passion and with great colour and great excitement. You've got about 70 different social media accounts. I try and follow at least half of them. And the terms that you invoke are so colourful and so rich. And half the time, I think, surely Miguel has made this up, because how does he know that this has got notes of Norwegian chamomile and a slightly old ice hockey puck? And you come up with these things, and yet I then think about them and I can see where you've come from, because yes, they're a little on the extreme side, but that's because you're having to push somebody into a particular memory set or guiding them towards what something might be. And also, if you are handling 70 social media accounts, trying to find some other way to describe a Sauvignon Blanc, which does not lend itself to a great breadth of adjective.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Sauvignon Blanc. Let's start with this. Not every Sauvignon Blanc is a cat's pee on a gooseberry bush, as an example. So it's
a lovely term. Right?
Thank you. So the beauty of a sommelier or anyone involved in wine is to develop a vocabulary. And the best way to develop a vocabulary is not about tasting the wine, is to actually go and smell the fresh produce out there. If you see me in a supermarket in a vegetable section, I'm picking up every vegetable and fruit just to
realize. I've seen you being walked out of numerous supermarkets, yeah, picking up every single piece of fruit.
Yes, I've been banned. I've been red flagging. People might think this, I've been told, you know, guys, you don't pick up a green pepper to smell it and put my nose in it, especially remember the time of COVID. You know, we have to be careful what we spread out there. But but the truth is to develop a vocabulary. That's where I was fortunate. Growing up in Mauritius, different cultures, being given the access from an early age to different cuisine, from Chinese, Indian, French, Creole, there's a multitude of flavors. And this all build up and help in a way of doing food and wine pairing. And the other lucky side I had when I was growing up, my dad was a chef. He and I was exposed to the kitchen environment from a young age also, and the smell of food and all that. So it just goes a long way in terms of like the love of cooking, the love of sharing wine, and the love to actually be open in terms of taste. And that's one thing I always said to anyone about wine. Don't wear blinkers. Be adventurous. If you love Sauvignon Blanc, don't stick to Sauvignon Blanc until you die 50 years later. There are...
Well, if you only drink Sauvignon Blanc, it'll probably be 5 years later, but...
unless they have shares in some of the NTSC tablet there to help them digest it, you know?
You have to have this rich knowledge and understanding of wine to be a great sommelier, but you also have to have another really, really important quality, and that is people management and personal skills. You have them in abundance, but... how difficult is it sometimes as you are sommelier and you get some clown like me who thinks they know about wine and you've poured them a glorious bottle of Raoul Red that's 5-6 years old, it's hitting drinking perfection, and this person insists that no, this wine is corked, and you know absolutely full well that it is not, but here is the customer is always right. How do you manage that kind of thing as a sommelier?
As we say, the customer is always right, which is not always the case. However, as a sommelier, we have a degree of restraint where at times, as much as irritating it may be, there's a better word, which I will not use on your show, which, you know, when in the heat of the moment, we have to use our tech and we have to indirectly and directly try to tell the person that he or she is wrong. But there's a subtle way to do it. It's the interpersonal skill, the way of how we phrase it, and also make them aware that, yes, they have made a mistake. They might not be enjoying the wine, but they shouldn't just send it back because the wine doesn't taste the way it should taste. And this is the result of, again, if you drink one variety for the rest of your life and wearing blinkers, you're not going to see the wonderful world of wine out there. With its diversity of textures, styles, flavors, aromas, and all that. And as a country, it does not only happen in South Africa, it happens all over the world. And the truth is, education is everything, sharing is everything. And yes, understanding a few grape varieties or a few wine regions doesn't make one an expert into wine. It's a journey. And there is so much more. And thanks for social media, who has helped a lot in recent years to demystify the produce and to make it more fun and approachable and also more understanding. The reality is, and the good thing is, it's a dying breed. The one that always think they are right, think that their some is arrogant or the some is trying to sell them the most expensive, or the one that goes and write a 10-page review on some sort of social media or on Google Maps, thanks God it's a dying breed because there are so much information available nowadays that don't make assumptions about things when one is not in a position to do.
Oh, my damning reviews are always 12 pages, and I try and get them up daily. But yes, I am a dying breed. When you see this, you talk about things like social media. I think it's very important. We never want to dumb down wine, but we do want to make it more accessible because the industry has to grow. And we want people to not feel intimidated by wine. They must feel comfortable with it. And I wonder, I look at, say, the Sandeck, which is probably your flagship space for having a great drink. If you're listening to this in Cape Town, basically, this is Cafe Caprice in the heart of the Joburg CBD. As you sit out on the deck and Miguel and his team waltz around looking after you. If I go back a decade, if I'd been on the Sandeck on a Friday afternoon, I know what I would have seen. I would have seen plenty of bottles of Verve, plenty of bottles of Moutet Chandon, and then there would have been some cognac, some vodka, some bottle service. The kind of bottles that, by and large, were there so other people could see what you were drinking. And yes, there's an element, it's a cool place to hang out, and that's absolutely fine. I look now, and I think I was there a few Fridays ago, and there was still the odd bottle of French champagne and the occasional bottle of Remy Martin or similar that had found its way out. But I was seeing bottles of Villafonte. Yeah. I was seeing people with bottles of not just a run-of-the-mill Sauvignon Blanc, but a really nice Chenin. I was seeing people drink rosé, because the understanding is that rosé is now in a place where we can drink it without the risk of immediate diabetes. I was seeing a very different pattern to what I had a decade ago. Is that a fair assessment of where you have seen and are hopefully continuing to see South African wine consumption going?
You have indeed nailed it, Dan. The market is changing. The market is changing fast. One thing we need to remember, being in Johannesburg, we deal predominantly with a domestic market, locals. Support versus the Cape, where it is predominantly international visitors in the warmer month of the year. And what I've seen in recent years, and in fact, I call it, it's a frustrating experience being in Johannesburg for 16 years, is the fact that the market changes so quickly, so fast, continually evolving, that there is no comfort zone for a sommelier. When I was in Constantia, I can go away for 6 weeks knowing that the wine list in place will work. And there's no issues. But here it's different. I can bring in 120 bottles of a very exclusive Bordeaux-style blend, thinking it will last 2 months. I go away for 5-6 days and get a call or a WhatsApp to say, they run out. Impossible. But the reality is, the market is super dynamic. There is a sense of discovery where everyone is keen to learn. Yes, they want to be seen drinking the great stuff. The champagne brands you mentioned were in their heydays on everyone's table, which is not the case anymore. We've seen on the market nowadays over 30 different brands of champagne, and they are all doing well because no one is stuck with Moët and Verve anymore, because there's more than those two brands to discover. And the same when it comes to Sauvignon Blanc, Rosé. We've seen how the Rosé category have refined. Producers are making more a Provence style of rosé, dry. So don't worry about the blood sugar level and the rush in terms of...
The electric pink days are gone.
It's gone. It's gone. So the beauty of it is we are at the forefront of changes in South Africa. And something that needs to be said on your show is Johannesburg, and Sandton in particular, is the biggest wine market in the world for Cape wine. It's not London, it's not Germany, it's not Paris, it's not any of those big metropolitan cities. It's the fact that the action, the volume, the price point drives here.
And it fills me with a great deal of joy when I see that, because I see more people falling in love with South African wine. And to go back to your earlier point of you cannot just drink one variety for the rest of your life, it starts to build up that sense of adventure because people feel emboldened, but also comfortable enough to go, right, well, I have always drunk Sauvignon Blanc, I'm going to try some Semillon. Or I heard Miguel on Dan's show, I like Cabernet Sauvignon, I'm going to try some of this Cabernet Franc stuff he spoke of.
Indeed.
Or I'm going to go with something absolutely, completely and utterly obscure and try this wine that Miguel gave Dan on his show that I think was named after my cousin Clara, because I asked you to bring a bottle along. You actually bought two. You bought me back some Mauritian lychee wine, which I had before, which is a lot of fun. But then you bought me this, and this is basically you just flexing your muscles and showing how enormously cool and well connected you are, because there are probably about four people on Earth who could get hold of this wine. You are one of them. This Miguel Chan is some Claret Blanche, if I'm not mistaken.
Indeed, Dan. So in our glass here, we have the oldest Claret Blanche in the country, planted in 1977. 0.3 hectares, super limited, less than 600 bottle production. Why I brought this on your show today? Simple. Climate change, global warming, adaptation to new style of wine, rediscovering our past. Claret was one of the few varieties that arrived in the late 1800s, originally from southern France. It's one of the permitted varieties in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, one of the 13 varieties. It makes a very famous bubbly, the Blanquette de Limoux, out in the Rhone Valley. And it was brought in South Africa for two reasons. One, to produce brandy. It produced quite a big bunch of grapes. And secondly, to make bubbles. So all those carbonated bubblies of the 60s that was hugely popular, they were based on claret. It went into obscurity. It disappeared off the radar. We've seen the Swartland guys reviving the variety. And then Peter Cronje out in the Brother Kloof realized that there was some very old vines lying among some wheat field, neglected completely, and they managed to pull the record to find actually that block was planted in 77. Because it was not looked after, everything kind of died, and whatever they could resurrect and save was 0.3 hectare. And to see this variety now being produced on its own gives a different perspective, a different dimension, not only to brand South Africa, but it shows the energy, the innovation, and the fact that we are not following what the rest of the world is doing. The New Zealanders, they're all wearing blinkers, produce Sauvignon Blanc in bucket loads or in truckloads, I must say, and Pinot Noir. What else have they tried to convince to the world besides some great Chardonnay? That's it. What we're seeing here in this country is the diversity or the alternative, the resurgence of alternatives, either as old vines.
Which this is.
It's textural. This could be Burgundy in profile or Southern Rhone. It's complex. It's exciting. It's fresh. It's lively.
And it's got a wonderful richness that makes it, on a cold winter's day, still a chilled white wine that still manages to give the kind of sustenance for which I am most grateful.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you, delving into this Mauritian South African wine lexicon of yours, difficult for people who are mostly listening, some of you might be watching, mostly my mum, be able to sample this wine, because it's not an easy one to get to. So bring it to life for me, Monsieur Chan. Find those tasting notes and that scripted beauty that you bring to your analysis of wine, and tell the world what you're drinking.
Here, what we have here is a brilliantly pure expression of the sun, citrus, which most white wine shows, but there's more to it. There's a floral element. It's almost like a jasmine kind of delicate floral. It's bright. There's a grip to it. There's a partial skin contact in this wine that adds a lot to the texture. It's medium to full bodied. There's a raciness. There's a vibrancy in terms of its beam of energy. Knowing that Claret Blanche is a variety that have relatively low acidity, it oxidizes quite quickly as a variety. What we've seen in this glass is it's been perfectly captured, not only in terms of its brightness and freshness, but the purity of the fruit. There is delicately ripe white peaches, stone fruit, nectarines, lemony, and floral. Touch of very old wood. It's fourth and fifth fill barrel. So it brings an element of spices without actually taking over the intrinsic quality of the variety itself. And the beauty of this wine is what it expresses as claret. Yes, it's easier to say what a Sauvignon Blanc may taste, or Chenin Blanc, or a Chardonnay. But when you have an alternative variety like a claret, which South Africa leads the way stylistically globally, there you have a wine that combines a character straddling between Burgundy South, Rhone Valley white blends, and something uniquely South African, which is the expression of the sun in it. It's lovely, it's brilliant, it's a gastronomic wine. It's a pleasure to savor on its own, but think about it with a grill, yellowtail on the braai, simple South African touch, some garlic, butter, fresh herbs. You don't want anything else in life. You just crush it.
And this is why Southern Sun spend 11% of their operating budget on Miguel Chan's salary. And there was no rehearsal to that. This is not take number 12. You don't have a script or a monitor up. There's no teleprompter going. That's just all a natural understanding of the wine. And that's what makes conversations with you so great, because you do have this ability to bring wine to life. And it's not often stuff that we aren't already aware of. We just haven't thought of it because we're not engaged in that kind of sommelier thought pattern where you're kind of 5-6 chess moves ahead on what is in this glass. So that was brilliantly done, and it's a lovely, lovely wine. And given that, 1,000, if that, bottles of this are made, I'm very grateful and honoured that you brought it along for breakfast.
It's been a pleasure to share it with you, and I didn't mention who actually make it. So this is
important.
I missed it completely. Well, the thing is, it's not something that's very well known in the market out there. It is produced by Uni Wine, which is one of the biggest wineries in the Western Cape. However, as part of their innovative project or trial and range, they are producing 8 different types of wine in minute quantities, about 1,000 bottles each. And this is part of the experimental discovery line, where it's about all vines or something that's rare that no one else has. And they are producing it under the Dash Bosch label. And it's just something for wine lovers, initiated or uninitiated. It's about keeping that open mind and be adventurous. There are gems out there. Go and seek them out.
Terrific wine with a lovely story. It's the ideal combination. Before we wrap up, and it has been an absolute delight catching up with the most famous Mauritian on the planet, I take you back to those Mauritian roots, but also to this sprawling portfolio you oversee across South Africa. You have the opportunity to touch down at one of your hotels, have one meal, and drink any wine on the planet. What would the combination be? Now, of course, you've got 41 properties, so 40 general managers are going to unfriend you on Facebook the moment this is done, but one will be extremely happy.
So let me put it this way. I'm not going to mention... Okay, I'm going to say it bluntly. I will sit on the sand deck, not because it is our flagship and our busiest spot to sell lots of wine. But I will go with a Wagyu burger, rare, and a bottle, to sound super boring, of Pinot Noir.
But which way? Is it South African, or you bring something from Burgundy?
Or I will have both side by side.
Of course you will.
Because then, whilst waiting for the burger to arrive, Wagyu burger to arrive, I will start with the South African. When the burger is there, I'll go with the Burgundy, and then I will straddle between the two glasses until the burger is over.
And is there a particular, I'm particularly interested in the South African Pinot Noir. Is there one that has etched its way into your heart especially?
I would go with an old school classic of mine, which is, I always considered as the pioneer of the variety in the country, which is Hamilton Russell Vineyard. And as much as there has been other magnificent Pinot Noir out there, out of Elgin, out of Walker Bay, the reality is I'm looking for restraint. I'm not looking for a showy red wine. I'm looking for purity. I'll go for that. When it comes to Burgundy, I will go something more in a Vernet type, kind of. But then again, it depends on the vintage. It depends what is on the list. And as you may know very well, the availability of Burgundy, as much as our friends at Great Domaine bring some magnificent wines of the world, I will not mention a producer there, because out of respect to the Burgundian, there are virtually excellence across each and every pocket, in each and every parcel. And the aim here is to have the restraint to match what is being produced out in the Cape with the burger, and that's it.
And as you said to me before we started recording, you do feel some of the very best French wine is now almost as good as entry-level South African wine. So we must remember that that is exactly word for word what Miguel said to me just before we started.
That's it. I need my bulletproof jacket now.
You, of course, did not say that. But what you have said throughout our entire conversation or alluded to is this wonderful quality of South African wine. Anthony Hamilton Russell, who looks like he's escaped from the set of Downton Abbey permanently, is somebody who does give us wonderful, wonderful Pinot Noir. There are many others following in those footsteps. But that option, that variety, that selection of wine gives me my last question to you, but probably the one I'm most interested in, and that is, with close on 500,000 bottles in your collective cellar across South Africa, with so many new and exciting producers giving us 1,000 bottles of Claret Blanche, giving us wonderful interpretations of a classic Cabernet Sauvignon or a Chardonnay, the variety is immense, the options seem never-ending. How on earth does Miguel Chan settle on what sits on those wine lists in those restaurants and manage to pare down from what I'm sure are the hundreds of bottles that land on your desk every single week, all hoping to catch your eye and make their way onto a Southern Sun wine list?
It's about having the vision. It's very important to have the vision of where the wine list needs to be, aligning our needs, operational needs, with what the industry is doing. It's not always about price, something I want to make clear, because many people think doing a wine list is about price point. Doing a wine list is not about price point. Wine is about emotion. If I receive a sample, or I receive hundreds of samples monthly, unsolicited mostly, when I taste a wine, if it doesn't move me, I don't ask the question. I just share the bottle with somebody else. If the wine moves me, then there is a place for it on one of the wine lists, on one of the 40 wine lists. When it has a place, it has a house, then I need to find a food to go with it. And that's where it's about the relationship with the executive chef, the hotel GM, or the team. Understanding the dynamics and the market they are trading in, and fit in the wine as we go along. And the beauty of a wine list is not about listing the same wines forever and ever. Buy 12 bottles, 24, 60, or 120 bottles of it. When it's gone, move on. Give somebody else the opportunity to shine, to showcase. And we as a SOM, our role, again, as I said, we are ambassadors. We need to showcase the best of South Africa as a priority, because we are a proudly South African hospitality group, which Southern Sun is, but also showcasing some of the benchmark of the world. So to do a wine list and to fit it in, it's a continuous work. It's always asking ourselves the question, and never ever fell in the comfort zone, which so many some does. When things are working well, stocks are moving, they fall backward and they think they are untouchable. That's the biggest mistake. It's to always wake up in the morning and say, it went wrong last night on this wine, on this bottle, on this table. What could be better done? How do I fix it? Or how do I make it better? And how do I create the experience? It's all about creating experience for anyone that walks through. Either they walk in for a glass of wine, have a meal, have a business meeting or whatsoever. A bottle or a glass of wine is about creating something that simply cannot be erased long after the wine has gone somewhere else. So
there will always be a fair degree of populism to how you have to create these wine lists, because you do need to put wine on that is going to sell. But the fact that the nature of the wine list has shifted over the years under your watch is an indication of the work that you have done. And you've been an almighty champion of South African wine, for which we are most grateful. I know it cost us a fortune to buy you from Mauritius, but we're very grateful. And I know that there are many, many South African wine producers, but also many, many South African wine drinkers workers who directly or indirectly raise glasses to you for the work that you and your team do, because you showcase our South African wine success so wonderfully. And as we've seen today, stuff from slightly obscure and little known right the way through to the big blockbusters. It's a wonderful story you tell. So, Monsieur Chan, le roi du vin de Maurice et aussi l'Afrique du Sud, merci bien. That's,
merci, Monsieur Nicole.
It is always an absolute joy. And I think we have to rush now to beat the traffic, because we've got a couple of rare Wagyu burgers and four bottles of Pinot Noir
absolutely
to sort out for brunch.
Absolutely. We are ready for it. So, always a privilege to be on your show. And thank you for the warm and the kind words. And to more claret and all vines, appreciating all vines, which is a national treasure.
As is Miguel Chan, albeit an adopted one, the Mauritian who found a wine home in South Africa and has not left. And gee, are we grateful for that. My very special guest on Dan Really Likes Wine this week, the man behind the wine empire at Southern Sun, Monsieur Miguel Chan. Cheers.
Cheers.